Welcome to Blog Talk Radio in high fidelity.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Fly Brother Radio Show on the Industry Entertainment Network. I'm Ernest White II, storyteller and explorer, and creator of the multicultural travel website flybrother.net. As part of my storytelling, I've had my travel writing published in places like Time Out Magazine, USA Today, Getaway Magazine, Panorama, Travel and Escape, Ebony, and at TravelChannel.com. I've lived in 5 countries and traveled to over 50, and I'm not saying all that to say that I'm all that. I just want to give you a little motivation, some inspiration, a few tricks and tips to go off and live an amazing fly life for yourself. Today on the Fly Brother Radio Show, I talk to Sophie Ibbotson, British entrepreneur, traveler, writer, and lover of wild places. Sophie runs her own consultancy business, Maximum Exposure Limited, is the author of 5 Brat travel guides, and has also written for Newsweek, the Financial Times, and the Sunday Telegraph. Sophie studied Oriental languages at Cambridge University and has since worked in dozens of countries, from Afghanistan to Sudan. She's a trustee of the Royal Society for Asian Affairs and has lectured twice at the Royal Geographical Society. We'll talk all about travel to some of the world's least likely tourism destinations, guidebook writing, languages, and a whole lot more. But before that, every week here on the Industry Entertainment Network, we highlight a community partner, either a small business, charity, or community service organization. This week, we're highlighting the Now Boarding Corporation. The Now Boarding Corporation is a nonprofit organization determined to increase annual study abroad rates among minority male youth across the United States. Based in Los Angeles, this organization targets high school teenagers from lower economic backgrounds. Currently, African-American males make up less than 2% of annual study abroad statistics among undergraduate students in the United States. The Now Boarding Corporation will offer unique opportunities for minority males to embark on culturally enhancing experiences with no out-of-pocket expenses. For more information, please go to www.nowboardingcorp.com and let them know that the Industry Entertainment Network sent you. We'll be right back with explorer and entrepreneur Sophie Ibbotson on the Fly Brother Radio Show right after this.
You don't know how lucky you are, boys. the USSR.
Welcome back to the Fly Brother Radio Show. I am here with my friend Sophie Ibbotson, who is an entrepreneur. She's a traveler. She's all over the map. She's in places that people don't even think has, you know, tourism. So you've been to, where are some of the more far-flung places you've been to, Sophie? And thank you for coming on the show.
Hi there, Ernest. Thank you very much for having me on the show.
Excellent.
Whenever people say to me, where is your favorite travel destination? Where's the best place to go on holiday? I always tell them Afghanistan. And part of that is because I like to see the reaction, but also
right.
I think it's a fantastic country to explore. Obviously, if you're in uniform, you're going to have a little bit of a tricky time there. But if you're traveling as an independent tourist, actually, there's a huge amount to see, and large parts of the country are quite safe. So Afghanistan is certainly an unusual destination. In the brief period after independence, when it was safe to travel there, I actually wrote the first travel guide to South Sudan.
Wow.
The world's newest country.
Yes.
I wouldn't recommend going there now. It's in the middle of another civil war. Okay. However, that was pretty curious. I spent a lot of time traveling in the former Soviet Union, particularly the Central Asian republics, and then dipping in and out of Eastern Europe, Middle East, Indian subcontinent, East Africa, basically wherever I can go and explore, find something new.
Well, what got you started into going to these off-the-wall places?
I come from a family of travelers.
Okay.
And people who are, I think it must be curiosity in the genetics.
Okay.
My dad's sister lived and worked in Afghanistan in the early 1960s. She went there with VSO, the Voluntary Service Organization, was teaching English in Kabul in 1961-62.
Okay.
And I grew up with these stories of this intrepid lady traveler taking off to Afghanistan on her own. And I thought, well, that's the kind of traveler I want to be.
Right.
And then other family members lived in India, Sri Lanka. My dad lived in Bolivia for a while. And I think just as a kid, looking at people's photographs, seeing the things they brought home, listening to their stories, I was always like, well, England's lovely, but it's not all that exciting. There are so many places I want to see.
Yes. At least with better weather.
So any opportunity I've had, I've been like, okay, let's go see something.
And you haven't stopped since then?
No, I think I'm up to 50 or 60 countries
wow.
now, and I'm not planning on stopping anytime soon.
Excellent, man. That's a wonder and a blessing. And are you based in London?
Yeah, I'm based in London. I was living overseas for about 10 years. Which was when I did a bulk of my traveling, moving sometimes every couple of weeks from country to country and
oh, wow.
being abroad for 8 or 9 months of the year. I've been back loosely in the UK for the last 18 months. I haven't stopped traveling. It just means that I use London as my base rather
yes.
than being a perpetual nomad with no home.
Right. No, and I feel like, you know, obviously it's easier sometimes to just be in a place with a large airline hub. Because otherwise, you're having to connect multiple times, you're paying exorbitant fares to get from place to place if you have more of a nomadic lifestyle, I find.
Yeah, and I mean, there are certain, I'm very fortunate that London obviously is very well connected to pretty much anywhere else in the world.
Yes.
And so from here, I can get to and from more or less anywhere in a reasonable time frame. There have been destinations, particularly when I was living in Central Asia, where it might take me 4 or 5 days of interconnecting flights
wow.
to get anywhere that I wanted to be. But from London, I can jump on a flight direct to most places.
Yes.
And then you can get a domestic flight or a local flight from there. And then jump in a car and then walk and then whatever to where you want to be.
Wade through the creek to get to the other
exactly.
side.
Exactly. I do try not to get my feet wet. I'm not terribly keen on water, whether it's swimming or wading, but sometimes needs must.
Yeah, that's true. And so then, all right, you studied Oriental languages at Cambridge. What would those be?
I chose to study Hindi and Urdu, so two languages of the Indian subcontinent.
Okay.
I studied French and German in school, as a lot of people did. I always knew I wanted to work abroad, and I thought, well, if I go and study French and German at university, I'll probably be constrained mostly to working
in Europe
or with Europeans, which is fine, but it wasn't particularly that interested me. I then looked into other languages I could study, and I think Well, there were two reasons that I picked South Asian languages. One, the other options, which were Arabic, Chinese, and Japanese, looked incredibly, incredibly difficult.
Right.
Whenever you speak to anybody who's studied those languages, they're like, wow.
Right.
This
is
really,
a
really tough.
Yes.
Exactly. Whereas Hindi and Urdu are both actually quite closely related to European languages. Mm-hmm. So if you understand French or Spanish in particular, you'll be able to grasp quite quickly the grammar of Hindi or Urdu. A lot of the pronunciation makes sense. There is a different script for writing the language, but it's quite logical. It is a syllabary, so each character represents a syllable as opposed to a character representing a concept as it would do in Chinese. So it's makes more sense if you want to say ah, there is a character for.
Right. Coming from the way,
get ideas into language with the script itself. So that was one reason.
Okay.
The second reason is that my family have got long links with India and with Sri Lanka. My grandfather and his brothers were born in India. There's a lot of British families have got links with the subcontinent, either through the British Empire or British Army. So my grandfather had grown up in India. My mother spent some of her childhood in Sri Lanka. And so I think there was a more natural tie and interest to the subcontinent as opposed to somewhere like China, which I had no exposure to or particular passion for.
Okay. I understand that personally, actually. I've been to China. I found it very interesting. And I said, okay, cool. I've seen it. And doesn't mean I won't go back. But, you know, some places loom larger in your heart than others. And India, for me, is one of those places.
I think so. Some places get under your skin and you want to go back time and time again. Mm-hmm. I first went to India when I was 18. I've probably been a dozen times to different parts of the country. I lived in India for a while, but there are still huge areas of the country I've never been to.
Mm.
And every so often, if I'm sat at home, I'll get wanderlust and I think, where do I want to go? Ooh, India.
And that's wonderful.
And it's always on my mind.
I was going to say, I mean, it's amazing to feel connected enough to a place that you can always go back and find something new.
And particularly with somewhere like India. I mean, it's basically an entire continent in its own right. So there is a huge amount of variety, whether you're talking about geography, languages, cultures, ethnicities, whatever it is. There is so much to see. You could spend an entire lifetime traveling around India and not see and experience it all.
Right. And so when you were living there, then did you get to use your Hindi or Urdu every day or at work?
Pretty much.
Or was it just out on the street?
I was studying, well, the first time I was living there, I was studying at the American Institute of Indian Studies in Jaipur in Rajasthan.
Okay.
And a lot of people, particularly in the UK, have this perception that in India everybody speaks English because of the history of the British Empire. But actually the reality is that very few people speak fluent English.
Right.
Some do, who've had, for example, higher education in English or have lived abroad or speak it at home. But the vast majority of people will speak a little bit of English, enough to get by, have a basic conversation. But if you want to go any deeper, then you need to switch into the vernacular.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that it enabled me to delve much deeper into local culture where I was living in Jaipur. But I think also it surprised people because people see a sort of white English girl and they don't expect her to speak Hindi. So quite often people would be chattering away in front of me or talking about me in an appropriate point in the conversation, I'd raise an eyebrow and interject.
In Hindi.
Or just keep
I heard that. Right, right. What, then were you able to kind of move into some of the other languages of the subcontinent? Malayalam, for example, or?
No, Malayalam is a completely different language. Okay. So the languages of North India are predominantly Indo-Aryan languages, okay, or Indo-European languages.
Yes.
So they're the ones which are close to European languages.
Okay.
But the languages of South India are a completely different language group. They're Dravidian languages. Mm-hmm. So they, there is nothing, they're not mutually intelligible. There's no combination, no similarity in scripts, no similarity in vocabulary.
Okay.
It'd very be much like saying to a Russian speaker, okay, talk to a Chinese speaker.
Okay, right, even if they have a border.
Yes.
Okay.
So Hindi and Urdu, there is a great deal of similarity, although they're different, written in different alphabets. There is some similarity between Hindi and Rajasthani, a certain amount with Nepali or with Bengali. And so sometimes if I'm listening to people who are speaking those languages, I can pick up a little bit of what's going on. I wouldn't want to try and speak those languages myself, because that's right, the point you'd fall over. But it would be the same way if you were speaking, for example, if you were a French speaker and you were in Spain or you were in Italy, you'd be able to get the gist and pick, yes, up some of the words of what was going on,
right,
even if,
right,
you didn't understand the fine details.
Okay, okay. Well, moving from India, which now you got me like excited about future trips. I'm like, oh my God, like you're right. There's so many places I haven't been there. You've written 5 travel guides for Brat, which
yes,
here in the States, a lot of people haven't necessarily seen the guidebook. I would say my first exposure to Brat guides was when I went to Cape Verde in, mm-hmm, like, in, I don't know, 1998 or something. And that was basically the only guidebook to the country.
Yeah.
It was produced by Brat. So
Brat's an English guidebook company. It was founded about 40 years ago. And it's quite a small niche travel publisher still. And what they've realized is that there is no point in them going head-to-head with Lonely Planet,
right,
with Rough Guides, with Frommers, who have got massive budgets, massive marketing capacity. And so what Brat does instead is, rather than producing a guidebook to France, a guidebook to Florida, a guidebook to India, they pick off all of the small countries or islands or regions which nobody else is really looking at.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, Brat has got a guidebook, I think, now to every single country in Africa.
Oh, wow.
Including places like Djibouti or Sierra Leone,
mm-hmm,
countries which...
Yes, don't have a lot of coverage.
A lot to see,
right,
but don't get a lot of coverage, and it wouldn't be worth the while of Lonely Planet to do a single country guide to that country. They might include it in their East Africa guide,
mm-hmm,
for example.
Mm-hmm.
But it, for the print runs, you're talking like 5,000 or 10,000 copies. It's not worth the big guys getting involved.
Right.
And so Brat has found that actually their niche is the sorts of areas which are a bit more off the beaten track. So we're talking about... interior of Africa or parts of Central America, former Soviet Union, and so on and so forth.
Okay. So what are the 5 guides that you've authored?
I wrote the guidebook to Tajikistan and to Uzbekistan, 2 of the countries in Central Asia.
Okay.
I did guidebooks to Sudan and South Sudan. Originally, it was just going to be 1 guidebook, and then the country divided in a few years ago, at which,
okay,
point we decided actually we needed 2 guidebooks rather than 1. And then the 5th guidebook I did was to Kashmir in the northern part of India.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, again, a bit like with the Sudan, South Sudan issue, this was supposed to be a guidebook to the entirety of Kashmir, so the parts which are claimed by Pakistan and by India. But unfortunately, the security situation in the Pakistani part of Kashmir deteriorated significantly when we were researching the guides, and the decision was taken by the publisher that they really didn't want to be recommending people travel there,
mm-hmm,
because of the security situation. So
right,
the guidebook instead focused just on the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir. So it's
okay,
the Kashmir Valley and Ladakh, which is people may be more familiar with as Little Tibet,
okay,
high up in the Himalayas.
Okay. And so then I actually have had the opportunity to collaborate with you on the update to the Tajikistan guide, which was a phenomenal experience on the ground, interacting with people and going to every little nook and cranny that I could make it to in the country for the guidebook. And even then, you still, you know, can't get everywhere. But I wanted you to maybe explain a little bit about what it's like to put together a guidebook, because often not many people talk about the ins and outs of guidebook writing, at least on the Fly Brother show. So
I think it's an absolutely fascinating area. Lots of people say to me that being a travel writer is their absolute dream job. I would say at that point they haven't written a guidebook.
I would agree with you.
The glamorous side of travel writing is writing for the New York Times or writing for Condé Nast and going and staying in nice hotels and having phenomenal experiences at somebody else's tourist board's cost.
Right.
The reality of a guidebook, particularly to a very small destination which is not developed for tourism, is that you are riding by buses or hitchhiking or walking. You're staying in tiny guest houses, you're camping, you sometimes maybe are even sleeping on people's floors because the infrastructure is not there. There's not a developed tourist route which you can follow and say, okay, today I'm going to this museum, this restaurant, this hotel. It's a case of pitching out into sometimes a region which is completely unknown and thinking,
yes,
if I was coming here as a tourist, what might I need? What might I find when I get there? And how can I, as the travel writer, explain that to somebody who's just pitched up at the airport, maybe only for a long weekend or a week, and wants to get something out of this country? What is it that they need to see? What is it that they need to learn?
Right, right. And it's a very grassroots exercise, like you say. I mean, it's getting in there. It's interacting with people. Often there's a language barrier.
There can be a huge language barrier, particularly in that part of Central Asia, because it was part of the Soviet Union for a very long time. So most people will speak their local language, which in the case of Tajikistan is usually Tajik.
Mm-hmm.
If they have learned a foreign language, it would probably have been Russian.
Yes.
And it's only really the younger generation, those who have been born and been educated since the fall of the Soviet Union in 25 years ago, who will have started learning English.
Yes.
These people tend to be understandably congregated in the urban areas because that's where they've gone to university, that's where they're working. And therefore, if you do go out to the villages or driving long distances through the countryside, you may well not meet anybody who speaks a word of English.
Right, right.
And that's not to say that they are not incredibly hospitable and that they don't want to engage and communicate with you. It just means that you as the visitor have to be more creative.
Oh, indeed.
In the way that you reach with people. You get very good at charades, you get very good at drawing pictures, you get very good at pointing to what you want.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's exactly what happened to me when I was in the country looking for a hostel or someplace to stay in a very small town, Tojikobod, which was near the border. And that actually is kind of a rat. It's like saying Smallville. In Tajik, in terms of the fact that there's like so many Tojikobods. And I was in a shared taxi, and there was an older gentleman. He probably was in his maybe early 50s, looked kind of like a mullah, you know, a learned Muslim man, educated Muslim man. And he was asking questions to the driver about me. He tried to talk to me, and obviously I don't speak Russian or Tajik. And which I thought would be helpful to a point, just because I assume that most of the readers of the guidebook wouldn't speak either of those as well. And so he's asking the cab driver who I am and what I'm doing and where I'm going and where I'm going to stay. I don't know exactly the words that he was using, but I do remember that he said journalist in Tajik, which sounds like the word in English. And eventually it came around to him inviting me home with him and his family to spend the night.
Yeah, and the people there are incredibly hospitable.
They have it was been phenomenal.
I think part of the reason, well, there's two reasons. One, Tajikistan and the neighboring countries were on the Silk Road. And so people have been traveling through there on business, as missionaries, as soldiers, as spies.
For thousands of years.
Easily 3,000 years and probably quite a lot more. And so although these communities are remote, they have never been isolated. Mm-hmm. There have always been people coming through from China, from the Indian subcontinent, from Russia, from Iran. And there is an expectation that when somebody passes through, that you will offer them tea, that you will offer them somewhere to stay.
Well, it was quite beautiful, that kind of, it came out very easily, that sense
and
of welcoming.
The second thing that I think runs in parallel to that is it's a country which is dominated by mountains and quite a harsh climate, particularly in the winter, but equally in the summer when it can be very hot, it can be very, very dry. And if somebody were to pass through your village and you weren't to be hospitable, that you weren't to offer them a place to stay, there is actually, historically and even to the present day, a significant risk that that person might just die on the road because they're not going to be able to find a market where they can buy things. They're not going to be able to find natural shelter. And therefore, you do have an obligation to humanity to invite them in, to make sure that they've got enough water, to give them directions about where they're going, to make sure they've got shelter. It's about doing the right thing to other people, because equally, a few months' time, you are probably going to be on the road and you're going to be relying on other people to look after you as well.
Yeah, that's a wonderful kind of way of summing it up, especially considering, again, that people don't speak the same language as often. But they're still able to be human and humane to one another.
The thing that impresses me most, I think, is not only do they not share the same language, but often these people who have absolutely nothing. Still, I mean, they see you coming as the foreigner, and, I mean, you're 100 times wealthier than they are. But there is no question about you paying for something. Yes, if you can contribute to what you've had, that's great. But the first thing they will do is they will offer you tea, they will offer you somewhere to sleep. It's not okay, pay me for it.
No, not at all. Yeah, exactly.
They just want to make sure that you are looked after and that they have done their duty. And I think to some extent they are seen by the rest of the community to be doing the village proud.
Mm-hmm. No, it was quite touching and it's quite memorable. And I will then talk about it. I'll tell people about it. I'll write about it, and I'll make sure that, you know, everyone that I talk to knows about this guy in Tojikobod who just extended every single hospitality he could to me, and how we spent the night communicating through, like you said, charades and hand signals and everything else we could to pass the time but be connected with one another.
And you realize, actually, that the vast majority of communication is nonverbal anyway.
Absolutely.
It's about how you greet somebody. It's about your expression. It's about the openness of your body language, the fact that you show interest in their kids, that you want to engage with them, that you look impressed and surprised by their house or by their garden or by their goat or whatever it is that they're showing you that they're clearly proud of. And the fact that you're like, wow, what lovely flowers, or, ooh, isn't that bread delicious, or isn't your daughter beautiful, whatever it is.
Yes. Oh, man.
And that sort of thing comes across. It doesn't matter that you don't understand the words. The enthusiasm and the recognition that what they're showing you is something important to them is very, very important.
Indeed. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I would love for you to talk more about the countries of Central Asia and some of the places that are not known to be tourist destinations, but that have so much to offer the world, but also people who visit. We'll be right back.
Brand ambassadors and business owners, the NEN has two questions for you. Are you ready to captivate thousands of new prospective clients, and are you ready to take your brand to the next level? If the answer is yes to both, then the Industry Entertainment Network is here to help you get there. Advertise with the NEN to give your brand the exposure that it needs on a national and international level to a diverse audience of substance and value. The Industry Entertainment Network is a global entertainment platform that highlights the positive aspects of music, film, culinary, lifestyle, and the beauty industries, with an emphasis on social and cultural issues. Our network features several evolutionary and elevating talk shows that are sure to appeal to your target audience at a fraction of the paid advertisement cost. Increase your business's and brand's value by taking advantage of our customer reach today. Contact us via email at www.welcometotheindustry@gmail.com or by calling 904-469-7511.
Welcome back to the Fly Brother Radio Show. I'm Ernest White II here with Sophie Ibbotson, explorer, writer, entrepreneur, a woman of many experiences and cultures and countries. And again, thank you for being here today. Love having you.
Thank you, Ernest.
Okay, so you were going to talk to us. I know, right? I know. It's host
no, totally. I feel welcome. Okay. It's like being back in Tajikistan.
Well, I'm American.
Are you going to show me your goat? Obviously not the right question.
Exactly. All right, So, again, we're going to talk about why places like Tajikistan, the stands in particular, are phenomenal. I knew nothing about it. I'm sorry. Let me just preface that with I knew nothing about these countries other than, like, the capitals that I learned in high school right after the breakup of the Soviet Union. You were looking for somebody to help update the guide, and I volunteered, and we talked and settled on the job, but I still knew very, very little about the region that I was going to, which was exciting. You know, it was one of the few places in the world that I hadn't been or hadn't even been close to. And so, yeah, I mean, I felt like it was my job to try to explain why this place is so incredible. So can you do that a little bit?
It is hugely exciting. And the thing that I love is the fact that you are somebody who is well-educated, well-read, well-traveled, and you still knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
And these days when actually we always talk about how small the world is getting, how easy it is to get from A to B, actually there are still places that you can discover something new.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the phenomenal thing about travel in general, but particularly about a region like Central Asia, which really is a bit of a black hole in most people's knowledge.
Yes.
I think there's a number of reasons that it is a black hole. One, historically, it's always been quite difficult to get to. It's an area of big deserts. It's areas of steppe land, areas of mountains. And so there were geographical barriers which stopped people easily moving through that area. That's not to say that they didn't, because as I mentioned in the first half of the show, the Silk Road went through there. So there have always been people traveling through, but not large numbers of people. Scrolling forward for the vast majority of the 20th century was part of the Soviet Union. It was behind the Iron Curtain. And although other parts of the Soviet Union were relatively accessible, I know, for example, a number of my American friends were able to go to St. Petersburg or were able to go to Moscow during the 1970s, 1980s. Actually, Central Asia really was pretty cut off. There were a number of reasons for this. One, it was very, very underdeveloped, and therefore people didn't necessarily want to see it, or the authorities didn't want people seeing it. Two, it was very sparsely populated, and so countries like Kazakhstan were used for nuclear testing for the Soviet Union's arms, equally for launching rockets into space at the Baikonur Cosmodrome. So Yuri Gagarin, the first man into space, actually was sent up there from Kazakhstan.
Oh, wow.
So there were these sorts of strategically important sites which were put into Central Asia, which meant that the authorities in Moscow probably didn't want foreigners wandering around there. It was just easier to keep everybody foreign out of Central Asia, partly so they didn't see the bad things, but also so that they didn't see things which were strategically sensitive.
Yes.
Moving forward to post-independence, all of the countries in Central Asia got their independence from the Soviet Union in the early 1990s. They inherited a lot of the bureaucracy from the Soviet Union. They also inherited quite a lot of the paranoia from the Soviet Union. So from a point of view of a foreigner trying to get visas, trying to travel around, it was very, very hard. These countries had also had almost complete economic collapse after the fall of the Soviet Union. So they had their own problems to deal with. They weren't really looking to attract tourists and encourage them to their countries. They were focused on surviving.
Mm-hmm.
But thankfully now we're moving sort of 25, 27 years on from independence. Economically, they've stabilized. Politically, they've stabilized. And therefore, there is the opportunity for these countries to say, OK, we've got ourselves sorted out. Now we want to tell the rest of the world about ourselves. We want to share our culture. We want to show our natural wonders. We want to share our history. And they're starting to push tourism to, yes, countries, neighboring countries like Russia and China, but also encouraging visitors from Europe and from the US and further afield to actually come and visit. So, for example, Kazakhstan, which is the biggest country in the region, is hosting the World Fair this summer. The Expo 2017 is being hosted in Astana. And the idea is to bring the whole world and their pavilions to Kazakhstan,
mm-hmm.
And to make a sort of a big celebration of world culture, but focused on Kazakhstan.
Okay.
A lot of the other countries in the regions have been improving their visa regimes. So if you're a EU passport holder or a US passport holder, you'll no longer need a visa, or you can get a visa on arrival. They're pushing getting direct flights. So rather than having to take 17 or 35 hours worth of flights,
yes,
via Istanbul or Dubai or Moscow, you can actually get on a flight in London and get off in Kazakhstan or get off in Uzbekistan,
mm-hmm.
which obviously makes it much, much more attractive, particularly if people haven't got a great, very long amount of holiday.
Right.
The ability to have direct flights, they're cheaper, they're faster. It makes these areas much more accessible.
Well, that's true. I mean, it's exactly on the opposite side of the world from the United States.
Yeah.
And even going through Istanbul on Turkish Airlines, which is pretty much the only airline that belongs to a major alliance that flies to Tajikistan, it only
yeah.
goes between Istanbul and Dushanbe three times a week. So
yeah.
it does make it that much harder for a place.
Fortunately,
that
the other country is a little bit better connected.
Well, that's true. Well, you know, I have love for my first little
and understandably
Asian
so.
Country.
Tajikistan
right.
is absolutely beautiful, and I think that's the thing that strikes me every time I go there, is that the mountains are so huge,
yes.
so dramatic, so unspoiled, and you can get away very quickly. If you're driving along a road, there might be a few little houses there, but actually you only need to go up into a side valley, you can hike for a few hours, and you are miles and miles away from anybody.
Yes. Yeah, it really is like being on another planet.
Oh, completely.
Yeah.
And that's exciting.
It is. And I mean, you know, it's you do start to feel like you might be a little bit high, because every time you go through a tunnel or around some kind of mountain bend, you're just like, this is the most beautiful countryside I've ever seen. Like, there's so many colors of brown and all this stuff.
green. They have green.
Well, definitely. They have so much beautiful green spaces, but I guess the thing is, like, even in the arid spots that, you know, from a traditional sense, you don't find beautiful, they're beautiful. You know, those kind of rugged areas that don't get much rainfall, that don't have that much obvious life going on, they're still just otherworldly and breathtaking.
Yes.
And then
when you look up at the horizon, you can always see the bigger mountains with their
snow
tops.
Right. And then the areas that are green, I mean, it's like something out of Lord of the Rings, you know, with this ridiculously aquamarine electric blue water. It's like, what the? This is not the natural color of water. Like, their water
is
nuclear. I know. It just seems so, it looks like it's got food coloring in it or something. It's so, it's been photoshopped, but it's real.
Yes.
And then
one
the people
of the really
are
nice things about the mountains in particular, which will appeal to climbers, is that actually in Tajikistan and in neighboring Kyrgyzstan, there are still a significant number of unclimbed peaks. And they're not necessarily that huge. We're not talking sort of K2 height of mountains. is just the sheer number of mountains and the relative inaccessibility of the region means that people have never climbed them.
All right,
and so
audience,
if you are a climber who wants to have a first and name a mountain after yourself, this is the region to go to. There are peaks waiting to be climbed, which could be climbed relatively easily.
You heard it first here on the Fly Brother Radio Show. There are peaks in Tajikistan, and you said Kyrgyzstan?
In Kyrgyzstan as well, yes.
That you can raise up and plant that flag. Do it, guys.
So if you want to Ernest White the Second peak, it's the place to go.
They'd probably have to lower me down from a helicopter. But
I'm not sure that counts. I think you may have to claim it under your own steam.
Darn. Well, okay, so then I've only been to Tajikistan. I stopped for like a day in Bishkek over in Kyrgyzstan, en route from Mongolia to Morocco, interestingly enough. So what are some of your favorite parts of that region?
I think it depends very much what you're interested in. If you are interested in history and culture, the best country in the region to visit is Uzbekistan, because unlike the other republics in the region, Uzbekistan had a much more settled population. They weren't nomads, they were traders, and they built cities along the Silk Road with the money that they made from trade, and therefore they established some of the biggest and most impressive cities of the medieval world. There are four cities in Uzbekistan which are UNESCO World Heritage Sites. Three of them, Bukhara, Samarkand and Kiva, are absolutely spectacular. Entire cities of really bejeweled buildings encrusted with mosaics made from lapis lazuli, from turquoise, gold, and covering mosques, palaces, minarets, harems, baths, whatever you want to think of, they are covered in mosaics. And so if your interest is in the sort of architecture and history and culture, that is a phenomenal place to be. Crossing the border to Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan's a bit of a curious place because it's got one of the lowest population densities in the world. It's a country the same size as Western Europe, but has a population, I think, of about 16 million people. So it's hardly anybody lives there. Okay. And the people that do there live in relatively few cities.
Okay.
But the capital was a city called Almaty down in the southeastern corner of Kazakhstan. And after independence, they decided that they wanted to build a new city, new capital city from scratch in the north. So in the same way that Brasilia was built from scratch, or Islamabad.
Or Washington, D.C.
Astana. Well, to some extent.
Yeah, except for Georgetown.
Yeah. So Astana has been built from scratch in the last 20, 25 years, and they have brought in the most famous architects from around the world. Norman Foster, the British architect, has built or designed, and they have built a number of the buildings, including the world's biggest tent. It's called the Khan Shatir, and it's an absolutely extraordinary structure. It has got internal canals, I think is the best way to describe it, with gondolas, so you can feel like you're in
Venice.
It's got beaches, it's got shopping malls, it's got concert halls. It's just the most extraordinary place. And because Astana, in a tent, or a tent-looking like structure, the temperatures in Astana swing from something like 40 above, and I'm afraid I can't tell you what it is in Fahrenheit, but in Celsius, from about 40 above in summer to 40 below in winter.
Okay, that's like over 100 in Fahrenheit.
All of this tent is temperature controlled so that you can go to the internal beach, regardless of the temperature outside.
Yes.
They've also got another building in the city is a glass pyramid. And so these really extraordinary structures in a city built completely from scratch. There are those who say there's really no need to have a city there at all. But from a, if money was no object and you wanted to build a fantasy city for the future, you would probably come up with something a little bit like Astana. And it is such a huge contrast to anything else in the region that makes it quite an exciting destination to visit.
Okay, now what's, are people actually moving there and making it an organic place?
They are, but it's slow. And the government has really had to provide incentives to do it. So the most obvious example was originally, obviously, all of the embassies and all of the foreign organizations were based down in Almaty, the previous capital.
Mm-hmm.
And it really took some time to convince the expats that they wanted to move up to Astana.
Largely
because of the extreme climate that is there. But gradually, the embassies have moved up, the consulates have moved up. Foreign organizations, the OSCE, banks, so on and so forth, have established their national headquarters in Astana. They're building a big new financial center, things like this. So there is slowly a draw of people to Astana. And obviously, the more the city develops, the more facilities it has that people want to use, the more attractive it becomes.
Okay. That actually is like Brazil, just because when they opened Brasilia in like 1960, you had to try to convince people to move from Rio de Janeiro.
It would be a very similar, very similar case.
I mean, everyone was like, hell no, I'm not moving. So, you know, the government had to ante up some cash. And it's only just now, and I lived there briefly in 2012, or 2010 actually, just now kind of coming into its own 50 years later with a couple of generations of people born there. And so they actually feel a connection to the place that the migrants, if you will, never would.
So it's going to take its time.
Right.
And the Kazakh government has been doing what it can to accelerate the process.
Okay.
But still, it takes a while.
Now, how would you compare, because here in the States, obviously, we are not getting the whole picture through the media. And many people, geography isn't their strong suit anyway, so even if they've heard of these places, they hear Stan as the suffix, and all of a sudden it's camels and war. How do you distinguish when you're talking to people about the differences among the different countries?
Well, first things first, there are camels. Which is very, very important.
They exist.
They are Bactrian camels, so they're ones with quite long, shaggy fur, rather than the sort of archetypal camels that you'd find in somewhere like Egypt.
Dromedaries, yes.
Yeah. So they do have camels, but they are cold-weather camels. So you might occasionally see them, particularly if you were doing a road trip in Kazakhstan, you might well see a herd of camels wandering around, but they are Bactrian camels rather than the conventional kind of camels. So if you're hoping to see camels, yes, you might well see camels. There are more exciting forms of wildlife.
Okay.
My personal favorites are marmots, which are sort of fat rodents, really. I always think they look a bit like a beaver, but without a tail, but fatter and more orange, which you tend to find in the sort of dry, deserty areas.
Okay.
If you would go up in the mountains, you can find ibex, snow leopards, and also Marco Polo sheep, which are named for Marco Polo, who supposedly went through the region. But they have absolutely massive curly horns and very, very rare and very, very beautiful. So there is exciting wildlife other than camels. When it comes down to war, actually, the Central Asian republics are very, very safe places to travel. Tajikistan did have a civil war in the early 1990s, but as you'll be able to attest, really, there's very little sign of it today. You certainly feel very safe traveling around. It's a long time ago. That sort of security problem never affected Kazakhstan or Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan anyway. There's a number of reasons for that. One, the low population density. If you're going to have a conflict, generally you need people to have a conflict with, which sounds like a really obvious point, but if your population is very spread out, it's hard to rouse people into armies or anything else. Two, the leaders of the countries on the whole, particularly in Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan and Turkmenistan, were Soviet era strongmen.
Yes.
There are issues with them. There have been over the years a number of allegations about human rights, which there are genuine concerns in that regard. But they have run relatively secure, albeit authoritarian, regimes where any sort of rebellion or rising terrorism, for example, has been put down very, very quickly.
Yes.
And the result of that has been that they are relatively safe places for the people who live there and for people who visit. Every now and then, I mean, for example, with the problems in Syria, there have been reports saying that there are, for example, Uzbek fighters in Syria who have been radicalized. But the suggestion is not that they were radicalized in at home, but they were migrant workers who had gone to, for example, to Russia. And were radicalized there because right. they were very impoverished, vulnerable, and certain recruiting groups basically went round vulnerable communities and said, right, well, you come work for us and we'll pay you twice the amount that you're earning labouring on the building site or whatever.
I mean,
And so when wages are low and unemployment is high, it's a fertile recruiting ground.
Yeah, I was going to say a matter of economics, right?
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this then, because we're talking about most of the, if not all of them, are majority Muslim countries.
Mm.
And, you know, you're a woman who's traveled through these places, I assume, often by yourself.
Yes.
How do you find it traveling there as a solo female traveler?
I've never had any problems traveling there as a solo female traveler. There's a number of reasons for this. One, we were talking earlier on about the culture of hospitality in these countries, and any visitor, it doesn't matter whether they're male or female, you have to look after them. There's a great sense that when somebody comes into your community, you have to care for them, and therefore anybody who was hassling a woman, it would be a matter of shame for the community. The second thing I would say is that because these countries were part of the Soviet Union for so long, although they are Muslim countries on paper, the reality is that most people either have a very vague understanding of what Islam is, or they're atheists. Atheism was the state religion of the Soviet Union, if you like. It was communism as opposed to communism replaced religion.
Yes.
And so for the most vast majority of people, they have really no, they're not practicing in any religion.
Mm-hmm.
And those who do, it's maybe you'd go to the mosque sort of once or twice a year, or maybe you'd fast, or maybe you'd wear a particular hat or a particular dress. But there's not, for the vast majority of people, it's not that religion is a key part of everyday life. Certainly, alcohol is prevalent, which is not something you would necessarily associate with a Muslim country.
Mm-hmm.
There's no issue with pork products. Women tend to be very much involved in the workforce, lots of women in politics, in business, in professions, certainly in the urban areas, very westernized dress. You would very, very rarely see a woman in hijab unless it was in a very conservative rural area.
Mm-hmm.
You do see women in headscarves in Central Asia, but that's more of a local cultural slash fashion thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because it's hot and you sort of tie your hair out the way. It's not a religious headscarf. It's just a headscarf in the same way that Russian grannies wear headscarves.
Right. Okay.
It's nothing to do with Islam at all.
Okay. Well, and I think that's very, I think that's a good point to bring up just because I want my listeners to go to these places. I don't want them, I don't want you guys to feel like it's unsafe or that if you go as a woman, you're going to be mistreated. Obviously, there's risk going out of your front door every morning anywhere. But
are risks traveling to Central Asia, but they are not generally caused by other people. The notable exception to that is the drivers.
Yes.
You will have traveled in some cars in Tajikistan. And you will have been sat, unfortunately, in the passenger seat when somebody else was driving. The standard of driving is not all that great. Certainly not compared to the UK or to the US. If you've ever been in traffic in Italy, you'll be find it much more familiar.
Right. Or here in Miami, which is very Mediterranean style.
Well, but there is a, sometimes you want to sort of hang on to the seat in front of you, or
right.
just grit your teeth when somebody else is driving. That is probably the single biggest danger.
Right.
Then, because of the sort of geography, if you're obviously wanting to go very high into the mountains, sometimes there's altitude issues. Mm-hmm. You might be very lightheaded or short of breath, and you could, theoretically, if you decided to climb one of these unclimbed peaks, end up with altitude sickness. Weather. If you're driving across a desert and you break down, you've got to make sure you've got enough water. You've got to make sure you've got sun cream. You've got to make sure you've got hats because of the heat. Be the same thing if you were driving across Nevada, for example.
Yes, yes, yes.
Or ditto up into the mountains. You want to make sure that you've got the right sort of...
Welcome back to the Fly Brother Radio Show. As Sophie mentioned before the break, you can find out more about Central Asia and other interesting, exhilarating parts of the world on Instagram at @maximum_exposure_PR and on Twitter at @maximum_PR. If you missed any portion of the Fly Brother Radio Show or would like to experience this session again, please log on to www.blogtalkradio.com/welcome to the industry. That's industry without the I, to listen to the on-demand version of the show. You can email me directly at ernest@flybrother.net, and please like the Fly Brother Facebook page at facebook.com/flybrotherfly. Please share any questions, content, stories, anything that helps me help others thrive. Listeners, please join us here next and every Saturday from 10 to 11 a.m. Eastern. That's GMT-4 for our international listeners. Thank you everyone for listening to Fly Brother here on the Industry Entertainment Network. Have a phenomenal weekend and an amazing week. Ciao, ciao.